Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Backers of the Marshall Islands in its international anti-nuclear fight say the battle has not been in vain, as other non-nuclear nations have been inspired to fight for nuclear disarmament. The Marshall Islands case at the International Court of Justice against the UK, Pakistan, and India came to a halt last week after the court decided it had no jurisdiction to hear the cases. Rick Wayman of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation says it's disappointing, but there's still hope. He spoke to Sally Round.
It was good to see a number of judges voting in favor of the Marshall Islands position. And there are a number of very strong dissenting opinions that were issued by some of the judges. It doesn't change the outcome. We would have much rather had a positive outcome. But given the situation, it was good to see that some judges were quite outspoken in favor of the Marshall Islands position.
And what were their arguments in favor?
Basically, some of the judges were just saying that the court was being much too strict and much too formal in its interpretation of the existence of a dispute. Many of the judges who voted in favor of the Marshall Islands position were saying that the court could have been much more lenient in its interpretation and understood that it was, I don't think they used the term common sense, but it was quite obvious that there was indeed a dispute between the Marshall Islands and those countries, simply based on the fact that the Marshall Islands is for nuclear disarmament and the other countries continue to modernize their nuclear arsenals.
What are the prospects now for this case going forward? What are the prospects for an appeal?
Well, there is no prospect for an appeal. This dismissal was quite final. As far as we know, the door has been closed on this approach. However, there is still a case pending in U.S. federal court against the United States on similar charges. So we're still waiting to hear back from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on that case.
It's been a long fight, hasn't it? And must be quite something for you at the foundation there and also for the Marshall Islands to have this end to the thing.
Yeah, well, the cases were filed in April 2014, so about 2.5 years ago. It is disappointing to have it end like this, but I do have to say that I'm very inspired by the Marshall Islands position, by the fact that they took this courageous action to begin with. And one of my main roles in this campaign was to mobilize NGOs and activists around the world to support this. And we got over 5 million petition signatures in support of the Marshall Islands action. We had 105 NGOs officially sign on in support of the cases. And so there was a lot of inspiration and a lot of renewal that happened among those of us working in the NGO field on nuclear disarmament. And I also believe that these cases, simply by filing them and seeing them through in the ICJ, I believe that the Marshall Islands has inspired other non-nuclear countries to step up and demand justice and take action. It might not look exactly the same as what the Marshall Islands did, but it did show that it's possible to step up and it's possible to change things. We don't have to wait for the nuclear-armed countries to take action themselves.
A lawyer representing detainees at Manus Island say he may file contempt of court proceeding against the Papua New Guinea government over its plan to close one facility on the island and keep another open. The lawyer, Ben Lomai, says the plan contravenes the PNG's Supreme Court ruling in April that the detention of asylum seekers is unconstitutional. Ben Robinson Drawbridge spoke to Mr. Lomai, who says his contempt proceedings could target the foreign minister, the prime minister, and the chief immigration officer for misconstruing the April ruling.
The 6th of April decision must be complied with, and that is that the detention centers should be closed down. But it seems that the government is not complying with the orders, so I have actually contemplating filing a contempt proceedings against Rimbing Paro, the immigration minister, and the chief immigration officer, Roburo Matayo, and as well as the prime minister, Peter O'Neill. They should remove this crop of asylum seekers back to Australia, or if not, to and arrange third countries, but not to allow them to stay on and have the center open.
Can I just confirm and distinguish the difference between the Lobram Naval Base Detention Center and the Lorengau Center? So the government is suggesting they will close the Lobram base but keep Lorengau open.
All the detention centers should be closed, whether it's in Lobram or in East Lorengau or even in any other parts of Manus, or for that matter in any other areas in Papua New Guinea. The Supreme Court has already nullified that order. It has already declared that the MOU of 2013 is unconstitutional and therefore it's unenforceable. And so any detention, either in Manus or outside of Manus, is still unconstitutional as far as in relation to the detention of the current asylum seekers as per the memorandum of 2015. So they have misconstrued the judgment with respect to Rinming Paro. He has misconstrued the judgment. And that's why I am contemplating filing a contempt proceeding against him and the Chief Migration Officer and the Prime Minister.
Can we just talk about the Lorengau Centre, because it's not very big, is it? How many people can actually be housed there?
It could be less than 300, or if not 250. It's a very tight facility. And also the landmass is very small in terms of the flexibility for the asylum seekers to move about. And it's another place where even if it's open, it also amounts to detention in itself.
The head of the United Nations system in Papua New Guinea says they are delighted with an international award given to the Prones Against Corruption initiative. Under the scheme, public servants are encouraged to send texts or other messages at no charge if they see funds that may be misused or activities that might be deemed corrupt. The scheme has been in place since 2014 and is backed by the UNDP. And Don Wiseman asked its PNG country director, Ron Trivi, how they ensure a system is not abused.
There is a group which has been set up within the department by the Secretary of Finance, who will then do a full report for the Secretary of the department to say, here's what we have found based on the text message that, you know, each text message that we've received. So there is an investigative process then, and clearly not every text message that's received, you know, it may not necessarily be a corrupt practice. It may not necessarily be public funds being misused or whatever. And those things need to be looked at carefully. And then where it is clear that there is no evidence to support an allegation, those things are dropped. But the beauty of the system, I think, is that, one, it acts as a huge deterrent for anybody who is even contemplating using resources for purposes other than the ones they're intended. And the second thing is that it has also led to the recovery of quite sizable amounts of funds, public funds, and a number of arrests and so on.
And clearly been recognised internationally, because Phones Against Corruption has won an international award.
Yeah, we are absolutely thrilled by this award, which is a very prestigious award, awarded by Government Insider, which is a publication, a global publication. And the Phones Against Corruption won this Best Citizen Engagement Award for this year. And it's great that Papua New Guinea is being recognized, the work in Papua New Guinea is being recognized for its innovation and so on, and trying to tackle, perhaps in a small way, an issue which is of public concern globally.
It has been said on a number of occasions that corruption at an official level in Papua New Guinea was systemic. So do you think it's becoming less so?
There are two points I would make to that, Don. The first is that, personally, I've seen no evidence to suggest that corruption is any worse in Papua New Guinea than in many other countries. That's the first point. The second is that actually corruption is not just the problem of poor countries. As you know, I'm a UK government civil servant currently working in Papua New Guinea, and we've had cases in the UK, we've had cases across the world actually of corrupt practices in both poorer countries and in richer countries. And the third thing is that, you know, it's hard to say whether the levels of corruption are less or increasing or staying the same. What I would say is that the ways of fighting corruption, that just as corrupt practices are becoming in some ways more sophisticated, the ways of fighting corruption are also becoming stronger and better. And there is definitely more transparency now in Papua New Guinea than there was some years back. And these things are, you know, important markers. They clearly won't solve the issue by themselves, but as part of a broader set of approaches to tackle the issue, I think this is a useful, very useful initiative, and it's great that it's been trialed and been shown to work in Papua New Guinea.
Coordinating leaders will be one of the main challenges for the Cook Islands and its efforts to achieve the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Parliamentarians from Pacific countries met in New Zealand at the end of September for a workshop on prioritizing sexual and reproductive rights in a Sustainable Development Goals, or CDG. The Cook Islands Speaker of Parliament, Nikki Rattle, says its national strategy plan is to align itself with the SDGs, which include eliminating poverty, gender equality, and climate action. But she told Daniela Maracola Cox, none of the national leaders involved have the latest information.
Very few of the national people are actually involved, and so therefore what would be important when we go back is to coordinate everybody involved. Coordinate the ministries, coordinate the civil society, coordinate the parliamentarians, bring everybody together and hold a workshop and go through what we've been going through today. And so deliver the same information so everybody start off at a level where as we do what we need to do within our individual areas, we can then be achieving what this is set out to do.
That's not an easy task, though. You're battling against people, first of all, with different opinions, different ideologies, different schedules, and also geographical difficulties because you are spread out across different islands to get people in. So is that going to be achievable, or will that take some wrangling?
And so what we need to do then is look at what's existing. It's looking at bringing the people from the outer islands for meetings or forums that we already have in place. And so while they're there, capitalize on that time. And then, of course, as we talk to the ministries, to the other partners, stakeholders, then it's being able to agree with everybody that this is going to be a good time of the year, because as we're getting closer to the end of the year, everybody will be preparing for Christmas, for the holidays. So we would like to do this. We have a big meeting happening in the Cook Islands in November, a Commonwealth Parliamentary Conference. And so we're hoping that we can either add a couple of days onto that or do it before and try and get this done then.
So let's imagine that everything has gone perfectly and everyone has managed to come together at the same time to talk about this. Yeah. What would be at the top of the agenda?
Yes, and I think it'll be very important then to focus on what we're looking at here about the themes of what the ICPD and the SDGs in looking at the welfare of women and girls, sexual reproduction rights, and looking at the education, the information being able to reach everybody, because as you said earlier, we have outer islands. So from a parliamentarian responsibility, each member who comes from that island, they can be actually take an active part in being able to take some of this information back with organisations, as in the women's organisations, the Ministry of Health, because every island has a health system on each of the island. There's a welfare officer. So it's trying to get everybody together to coordinate themselves, not just on the main island, but in each of the outer islands, and being able to engage with the community. And not just women, you know, there are young boys as well. Their sexual reproductive health is just as important.
Have you ever thought about a Skype link to the outer islands to talk to people?
The outer islands people are very, very active in the Facebook, and a lot of people talk to each other by Skype. So, you know, young people are very good at developing that sort of thing. So perhaps that could be something they could do.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. For the first time, Tonga's LGBTI community will be calling on government leaders to revise legislation in order to project LGBTI people. The Tonga's Leti Association has planned a national consultation with government leaders in December to petition for changes to the Criminal Offences Act. The act criminalizes cross-dressing and sodomy, which can be punishable up to 10 years in prison. The association's project officer, Henry Aho, says a three-day consultation will coincide with the United Nations International 16 Days of Activism campaign. He spoke to Indira Stewart.
This is going to be the first time that we actually invite people to come and sit around the table and talk to us and work together with us on such issues. Last year, the Pacific Sexuality Diversity Network hosted a human rights conference here in Tonga, and we had a few church groups who actually stayed outside the convention center and protested with banners saying, "Go away with your immorality." I think that was the first time we ever had an event like that here in Tonga. This national consultation will be the first time we actually step up, and it's just Tonga asking the Tongan government and all other sectors in Tonga to actually dialogue with us so that we could overcome these issues.
As we all know, in the Pacific, well, most Pacific countries, including Tonga, is a staunchly religious country. There was a lot of opposition to CEDAW being ratified. Have you received much opposition from any religious community members in terms of voicing concerns about this legislation?
Yes, we have under good authority a few religious organizations who are trying to actually reawaken these laws. They feel like with the Sunday law being reinforced, so to speak, with bakeries not being allowed to serve customers on the Sabbath, they believe that the next step for them is to reawaken these laws so that the morale of the country is put in check there. We are being pro-activist in that we would like to remove or safeguard our members of our community and remove these, remove the likelihood of any member of our community being arrested because these laws are in place. We feel like so long as these laws are in place, someone can use them against us, even though they haven't been used to date.
And in terms of getting pushback from the church communities, how do your members feel? Is that scary?
It is. It is. It's a lot of preparation that we have to do within our own community to prepare our own members for the backlashes that this might have, for the opposition that we are likely to face, and to tell them of what lies ahead and why we need to do what we're doing. Because if it's not us that will be affected, it will be other people that will be affected. So we are prepared for the opposition.
New Zealand's Māori and Pacifica Trading Training Organization this week handed over newly built houses in Fiji as part of the Cyclone Wilson Rebuilding Program. The group upskills New Zealanders and helps find them jobs, but took dozens of trainees to Loki Settlement near Lakuta to help build cyclone-resistant houses. The group's communication manager, Ben Chapman-Smith, has just returned from Fiji and told Alex Perolte families there are still in great need.
It's just going into a really poor community. It's hugely eye-opening to see how the people live there. So this home that we built was probably about the size of a generous workshop in New Zealand, you know. So if you had a workshop in your backyard, it was probably about that size, just one room. So what we did is we dug in and concreted in the pilings, so really strong foundations. So everything was concreted into the ground, and then just lots and lots of strapping. So everything was strapped down real heavily, so it's not going to lift off in a hurry.
These people have been through so much. What impressions did they make on you after you were kind of welcomed in and living in the community for a week?
The Fijians are just, they overwhelm you really with their hospitality. Personally, I just think they're the most friendly people I've met in the world. I'm just always blown away by the Fijians. Just everywhere you go, there's somebody saying Bula Vanaka to you, and even if you're just walking past them on the street or they're driving past you. We were really touched by this little settlement we went into because they're really poor people. I think mostly sugarcane farmers. They don't have much at all, and yet every time we sat down for a meal, you know, the table was sort of creaking under the weight of it. We weren't quite sure where all the food came from or how they managed it. We were just really humbled, I think, by the fact that they'd been through so much and were such a poor community and yet just were so generous back towards us. So the handover day for both the houses is coming up, and apparently that's always just a really emotional day for everybody involved. What we'd built there in a week was like a 20 to 30 year dream for these families. It was just, that was their whole life goal, really, was to have that little, what we'd consider a pretty small shelter, but for them that was like a, you know, like a palace. So it's a very humbling experience, and for our trainees, I think they were really moved by it as well. We know that it was really hot up there, it was baking hot, and there wasn't a huge amount of shelter, but the guys just got stuck in and just worked so hard. They were really inspired to do a good job. And
it shows you that even with a little bit of investment, you can make a, as you say, a difference to a family that's been waiting decades for that. It means so much to them.
Yeah, and look, and the thing is, in our team, there were some carpenters in there who had good skills, but some of the team, sparkies or plumbers or even hospitality, they didn't even have those building skills, but with a little bit of guidance, they could put to use what skills they had, or at least, you know, the desire to work hard, and that made a huge difference because they could do certain jobs like digging holes or, you know, just hammering nails and things. They didn't have to be involved in the planning and cutting timber on angles and more of the technical kind of stuff. So you don't really need to have a lot to make a difference up there, just the desire to go up and help and work hard and do your best. You know, I talked to the trainees and I know they just thought, mate, this is just such a worthwhile project and anybody could come up here and do this. It's just looking outside of our own kind of, you know, our own communities and seeing that there's a need up there as well.
A researcher has encouraged the New Zealand government to take into account Pacifica families when addressing housing problems. Otago University's Keita Moore examined the last three consensus, which show homelessness growing at an accelerated rate since 2001, to the point where 1% of New Zealanders were homeless in 2013. Dr. Moore says Pacifica are the highest hit when it comes to housing deprivation. She told Korea Vakatu 92% of homeless Pacifica have been found to be staying with family or to a lesser degree with friends.
Compared with the Europeans, the rate of homelessness among Pacific people is 10 to 1. So Pacific people are 10 times more likely to experience homelessness. We know that Pacific people are more likely to be living with family in particular or friends, and we only count crowded situations and only the extra people in the house as homeless, and they have to also have incomes below the poverty line and have nowhere else to live. They're the people that we count. The really worrying thing is that the government hasn't recognised that people sharing with others are homeless or kind of need any assistance or need to be counted. I think Pacific people and Māori and many other non-European cultures are much more likely to take people in for potentially a long period of time. I don't want that practice to disadvantage people and for the government to say, well, they're fine and they don't need any assistance.
People sleeping rough in the streets and in cars and things, I guess that's the perception people have when you talk about homeless people, that, but as you mentioned, that's not the case. Housing deprived people or homeless can be living with other people in a house.
We're talking about everyone who can't access housing, and we say, you know, if you can't access a basic rental and therefore you have to, you know, sleep in some other kind of temporary situation, we're counting all of those people as homeless or severely housing deprived, because we have to plan for all those people, and that's a kind of housing shortage for people on low income. So we need to measure all of those people. Most people, when they can't access housing of their own, are not going to go sleep on the street, because there's a number of options. They're not permanent options, they're not adequate options, but they're definitely better than the street usually. So a car, staying in a motel or boarding house, staying in your friends or family's lounge room or garage, and all over the world, but we think particularly in New Zealand, that's how homelessness manifests. And we know that that's the major driver of household crowding, and it puts everyone in the house under stress, not just those people who are homeless. But on the other side, you know, we are so lucky in New Zealand, and particularly among Pacific populations, that we are so caring for each other that even if it puts us at a disadvantage, makes life a bit more difficult for us, we take in people who are in need. But I wouldn't want that to disadvantage people and for the government to then say they're off the radar, they don't need any help because they've got a garage to sleep in.
Since your research, have you noticed maybe a change in approach? Because you've mentioned you don't want there to be any less urgency in addressing people that maybe have a cultural preference for living multi-generationally or have an extended family kind of environment.
I think definitely the public perception is changing. And, yeah, I think people are aware that this is an issue. And it's not going away. So that's really encouraging that, you know, the public are going to put pressure on something actually happening. But unfortunately, the government just continues to focus on emergency housing and not really looking at the big issues in terms of providing affordable housing and, you know, serious support services that some people need. They're still not funding those. And I think, you know, for Pacific people in New Zealand, we still design houses for, usually for a European nuclear family with, and, you know, we know, you know, Pacific people have been in New Zealand for so long, and we know that there's a preference for multi-generational living. So, but we're still not designing or building houses that account for that. So, you know, that definitely still has to change.
On the plus side, you did mention that, you know, this issue is in the public eye more and more, and we've had the 14 hours homeless events, for example, in Auckland on Friday, I think it was, as well. So there is a movement and awareness about this issue now, isn't there, that hopefully will move action as well?
Yeah, I think because everyone is now feeling housing stress, you know, the problems with the housing market, and, you know, and our incomes not being in line with, you know, how much housing is costing. I think people are now, because they're feeling that personally, are able to, you know, everyone is able to think about what situation people who are more vulnerable and with less resources must be in. So I think this is the perfect time, once, you know, when we're all kind of on the same page, to really do something about housing.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.